Hey, you're listening to part two of episode 131 of The Partially Examined Life. This is the second half of the second discussion, or the fourth posted episode on Aristotle's De Anima. We are now finally getting around to talking about the mind, which is book three, chapter three. And let's go with chapter three. Go!
Well, we should say by mind, we're translating nous. It's not mind in the sense that we think of it. We think of it broadly. And when Aristotle talks about nous, he's thinking specifically of contemplative intellect and the faculty by which we understand the world, which means to grasp the essences of things. So I just wanted to say that.
So where should we read in chapter three here? Not the beginning, which is boring.
Well, in the beginning, he's going to argue against the idea of previous writers, right, that thinking is just a form of perception.
Yeah, and he's going to make a distinction between perception and thinking and supposing and reflecting and imagination.
And the biggest difference seems to be that you can be wrong in thinking, that if you perceive something, you know, it's just your perceptual organ is filled with the form of the thing that you're perceiving. How could that be wrong? It's only when you identify it and say, hey, that's a dog, that you're doing more than just perceiving. You're making some sort of judgment. You're comparing it to the class of dogs or something like that.
But what you just said seems to directly contradict what we were talking about before as perceiving the whole of something. And we gave the example of you, well, you see the whole dog, right? You don't accumulate all those things together. So were we wrong about what we said before? Or is it that you see the whole dog as a whole thing, but the act of understanding it as a dog is a distinct thing?
He had a line in the previous, I think it's in book three, actually, in part of what we read. Sensation is of particulars and thinking is of universals. So if we want to think of the objects of thought versus the objects of sensation, it's particular versus universal.
Okay.
So it's the dog versus its dogness.
Yes.
We can perceive the dog. We can't perceive the dogness. Don't even try. Seth, tell us something about chapter three that you liked or that we should talk about.
And before it gets all complicated with a Markism or a Mark interpretation, what he says right at the beginning, this is 427b, is he says, we know that perceiving and understanding are not the same thing. And the reason why is if you think of perception in the Aristotelian sense as being this association of organs and special senses like sight and so forth, he says, you cannot be mistaken. Sensation is always true. Not sensation like we think about it, but sensation in the sense of sight cannot be mistaken about color. Hearing cannot be mistaken about sound. Touch cannot be mistaken about feel, whatever the appropriate words are. But you can be mistaken about shape, size, number, the things that are not special to the individual senses. And the reason this is important, it's that example that comes up, I think, three or four times in the text about whether somebody's the son of Cleon or something like that. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
It's identifying somebody from a distance, I think, is the point.
Basically, that's the idea. You can't be mistaken that what you're seeing is this white figure, but you might be mistaken that it's so-and-so's son. So if it's possible that you can be mistaken about something, which is certainly true about your judgment, there must be some distinction between understanding and perception. Understanding is not the same type of thing as perception. Where it got confusing for me in this chapter, which I think is a function of my translation, is that they bring up the term imagination, thinking, perceiving, belief, and I had a hard time separating out what all those things might be because he says, for example, imagination is different from thinking and perceiving. So he made a distinction between, I'm going to assume that understanding and thinking are co-equal in this translation. So we know that perceiving and thinking are different, or perceiving and understanding are different. But then there's something like imagination, which is different from those two as well. But imagination requires perception, but is somehow not accompanied by belief, or is not equal to belief. This is where I kind of got lost. So I felt like there was this typical Aristotelian, I'm going to start separating and distinguishing and seeing how things are the same or how they're different. But I got a little bit lost about how he catapults from understanding or thinking is not the same thing, perception, to getting into talking about the intellect more generally.
So he's actually going to conclude that imagination cannot be either opinion in conjunction with sensation, or opinion based on sensation, or a blend of opinion and sensation, for both the reasons given and because the opinion relates to nothing else than the object of sensation.
What is the difference between imagination and understanding here?
He gives the example of dreams. I think, so he gives kind of a definition on, at 428A, the process by which we say that an image is presented to us. I guess it's, there's a lack of clarity because it seems like a perception. We think of perceptions as being images as well. And I'm not sure what the relationship between the imagination and perception is here, but it's pretty clear he gives dreams and fantasies. Anytime we call up an image of something that's not actually there, that we're not actually perceiving.
Seth, I'm sorry. You were wondering why they're different, perception and imagination?
No, I get that they're different. What's confusing me is that in my translation, we have the term imagination. We also have thinking and understanding, and we have belief, or I guess what Wes calls opinion. And then this is right at the end of 427B and beginning of 428A. Thinking then is something other than perceiving, and its two kinds are held to be imagination and supposition. Understanding, whatever it is not the same as perception. And here's why. Perception can't admit of error. You can't be mistaken about any of the special objects of sensation. But you can be mistaken about common sensibles, which I take to be pointing to the idea that understanding or thinking is somehow this conjunction of all the senses working together, which is where the possibility, or as we discussed earlier, the common sensibles can come up.
So he's saying that others have said that thought is held to be imagination and judgment. And then he says, we'd best to discuss after having completed our analysis of imagination. I think he's going to reject that. It's confusing because he's not going to come out on the side of thinking being comprised of imagination and judgment.
That's fine, but can you help me with the Greek? What is the word, or what is meant by imagination?
Imagination is fantasia. I think it's just very commonsensically having of images that are not perceptual images that we might have in dreams, or we might have when we imagine something that's not directly in front of us.
So memory is a form of this, but he talks about memory in another treatise, so he doesn't...
Well, this section right here, 427B and 428A, is somehow important because he's making all these distinctions between imagination and thinking, and in my translation, what he calls supposition, and that somehow, what did you say, Wes, opinion?
Yeah, so we've got krinein, which is supposition or judgment. We've got knowing, which is thinking. And then we have perceiving, which is aisthenesthai, and then imagination, which is fantasia.
I'd just like to voice on behalf of the audience that actually adding the Greek does not make it easier.
Yes, it does. Because we have a bunch of different translations. And then doxa is opinion. So the faculty of judgment, this krinein or the supposition, is the way we make opinions. So to judge is to make an opinion. And that's different than imagination because our opinions are predicative. You know, we say X is Y and we can be wrong about that.
He later on in 428A21, that area, he links it up with having conviction. So if you have opinions, you have a conviction about whether it's true or not. And that's different than having imagination. And he links it up with conviction is not present in animals and beasts, but imagination surely is.
Right. So imagination is somehow a component. I'm trying not to use the word faculty, but imagination is something that animals and human beings do that's somehow considered thinking.
It's not considered nous, but I guess there are like 10 different words for thinking in here.
That's kind of what I'm trying to get to, is I'm trying to understand what are the distinctions he's drawing so that I can get a better sense, because it sounds like this goes back to what we talked about in the last episode about nutritive.
What he really said here is, look, I'm going to leave off talking about whether thinking is comprised of imagination and judgment, and I'm just going to go ahead and analyze imagination first. And that's what he does.
He describes a little bit about what it is. They're saying that it's different from perception and reflection. And then he, at 428A, sort of recapitulates what imagination is. Imagination is that through which some image comes about for us, if one is to say something non-metaphorical about it. So imagination is just like what Wes said, having an image of something before you. And then he asks the question, Is it one of the potencies or states according to which we discriminate or are in a state of truth or falsehood, such as our perception, opinion, intellect, knowledge? So he lumps those four things together as the way in which we assess truth and falsehood. He's going to say that we don't use imagination that way. And the next paragraphs go through each of those characteristics, perception, opinion, intellect, and knowledge, saying that, well, they're not like imagination. I gave the reason why for opinion, because it involves conviction. And perception is always correct.
Because it is reporting on something that is present, not bringing in abstractions. Imagination, likewise, cannot be bringing in abstractions. Thinking is connected here because thinking as well, he's going to say, is going to use images, but it doesn't do it in the same way as these other two. And perception and imagination, when we get to talking about motivation, they play immediately into this. We were talking in the last episode a little bit about how animals, at least the higher animals, maybe not bees and grubs, but other things, you know, perceiving and imagining and desire all go together. You see there is no food there and want it there to be food there and imagine the food and go do something about it.
Right. This all makes sense to me. Can you contextualize this for me and explain how this is getting him closer to a notion of what understanding is?
By bringing in the question of, does a perception involve a positive assertion or not? Does it involve belief or merely having an image in front of you? And that's going to be important. And how this plays out into practical reason is going to be important. I think imagination just is a way of isolating one of the pieces in the puzzle that does not involve directly an assertion. Yet it is, as I just said, tied into the motivational part.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it really fits. I mean, he gives that long analysis of the imagination and then he moves back to thinking and the ways in which it's not like perception.
I mean, I'm happy to kind of let this ride and maybe we'll get some more clarity further on. But there seems to be this structure where there are these then important distinctions. For example, can it admit of error or not? Is it accompanied by belief or not? I feel like what he's doing is he's kind of carving away as if he's trying to guide us to the destination, which will be, oh, this is this sort of thing that does admit of error but isn't associated, and that's going to somehow supposed to be the light switch or the light bulb for us. And I feel like maybe there's background there that I just don't get. Or maybe he's working inside of a context where I could see where he was headed, if I understood what that was.
Well, maybe if we get into some of chapter four a little bit, we can come back to that.
Okay.
Because I'm in the same place as you, Seth. I don't know how it's related exactly. So here we get this idea that in thinking something thinkable, we are receptive to the form of the object and so must be potentially the same as the object, although not identical with it. This is the way in which he's saying, if thinking is analogous to perceiving, then we're receptive to the form and potentially can become the same as the object, but not identical with it in the sense of just taking on the form. As the sensitive is to the sensible, so must mind be to the thinkable. And then he goes into this really interesting claim that the mind must be uncontaminated in order to know that it may be in control, that is, that it may know, for the intrusion of anything foreign hinders and obstructs it. Hence, the mind, too, can have no characteristic except its capacity to receive. That part of the soul, then, which we call mind, by mind I mean that part which the soul thinks and forms judgments. He's using a different word there, so I'm not sure if that's the opinion-making faculty or not. But anyway, by the part which thinks and forms judgments has no actual existence until it thinks.
Pure potential.
Yeah. This is a really incredible claim.
The Anaxagoras bit, that Anaxagoras was in the line of pre-Socratics, but hey, everything is water. No, everything is fire. Everything is whatever the hell Heraclitus was saying. And Anaxagoras is saying, no, everything is mind. Everything is nous. And for Anaxagoras, mind is a cosmic principle. And so Aristotle is connecting a little bit of, you know, he's been talking all along about, of course, it's the mind of individual human beings or other kinds of creatures, but though human beings are the only ones that have nous. Then he wants to, you know, and this is again the place where the Christians just jumped on Aristotle, say that there's something universal about this. There's room to talk about the mind of God. There's room to talk about mind in general. You know, mind as a principle, as Anaxagoras says, in order that it may rule, that is, it in order that it may know.
Well, he has an argument for this in the next part of this, which is that unlike sensation, it's not that you have these extremes, you know, you would be damaged by by thinking the extremes. So, for instance, he says, but when the mind thinks the highly intelligible, it is not less able to think of the slighter things, but even more able, as opposed to sensation, which if, you know, you're subjected to an extreme stimulus, you're, you know, say, blinded by light. And is that his only argument here for why the mind must be nothing until it thinks, or pure potentiality?
No, he says that if thinking is like perception, then it would be affected by an object, a thought object. And this brings into play this whole notion of the acted upon, the acting, the potential versus the actual. In other words, because you can think about anything, then if you were something that could have potentiality and actuality in the same way that the sense organs do, you would have to potentially have everything in you, because you could have any object that could conceivably impress upon it. And so it's not possible for whatever the intellect is to be something that has the potential to be everything.
So you'd be restricted in what you can think.
I didn't see it so much as him saying that we'd be restricted. I think he's saying the whole dynamic of potentiality and actuality makes sense when the organs are in accord with their objects. But when you're talking about mind, you're not talking about an organ. And so the idea that there's that same structure of potential and actual in place doesn't make sense.
It's not that it doesn't make sense, is that it gets to its limit, right? It's exactly like we were talking about sounds and hearing, except in the case of thinking, it's all potential because all of the world, all of nature is the other side of it. And so in order for it to be able to take in everything, it has to be all possibility.
Yeah, I'm just wondering why we might not think that it can't take in everything.
He's saying that it can take in everything.
So he says, so it is unreasonable to suppose it is mixed with the body, for in that case it would become somehow qualitative, for example, hot or cold, or would have even have some organ, as the sensitive faculty has, but it in fact has none. There is no particular sensory organ for thought. That's, I think, for him telling.
Which is why, to bring back this earlier point, the common sense, if there's a place that all the senses come together by which we coordinate them, that has to still all be taking place within the realm of sense.
Right. Yes. Mind is not what does that, interestingly, for Aristotle.
Can we give the answer of what the noose is? It's the form of forms. That's 432A. We can explain what that means and how we get there. The way I, Gendlin at least interpreted it, was just like the hand is a tool of tools. This is what Aristotle says in that same section. The soul is as the hand is. For the hand is a tool of tools, and the noose is a form of forms. The hand is a tool of tools because it can hold any tool. Apparently he elaborates this in some other text that's not the Anima. That the hand is just as good as a spear because you can have a spear in your hand. And so likewise, the noose does not itself become the form. It does not take on the forms of the things that it thinks about in the way that the eye somehow takes on the form of the things that it sees in the special sense, but it is a creator of forms somehow.
That's not the way I read that.
This is at least the way Gendlin interpreted that, you know, the hand is what creates the tools, so the mind is what creates the forms. Now, that does sound weird because it's not like the mind can just make up whatever forms it wants. It finds the forms in things. The forms are things in nature objectively.
So in my translation, it's not just form of forms, although it is kind of that in the Greek. It's the eidos, eidon. But it's the form which employs forms. We already know from his picture of the soul that the mind is a form.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's an interesting kind of form that is related to other forms out there in the world. So unlike the sensory organ, which is receptive to forms through this kind of, we can give this physiological account of it, the way in which it's affected and so on, with the mind, we're already dealing with something that's purely formal. So I didn't see it as creating forms, though. I saw it as receptive to them.
It's almost a grammatical distinction, right? Because when you say form of forms, it could mean what I think Mark was taking it to mean, which is it is the quintessential example of a form. Or it could be something that is made by or contains forms. And that's the way I think you were taking it, Wes.
Well, in a way, you might think of it as an extractor of forms. So this is kind of what we get right after mind is a form which employs the forms of sensible objects. But since apparently nothing has a separate existence except sensible magnitudes, the objects of thought, Both the so-called abstractions of mathematics and all states and affections of sensible things reside in the sensible forms. And for this reason, as no one could ever learn or understand anything without the exercise of perception, so even when we think speculatively, we must have some mental picture of which to think. For mental images are similar to objects perceived, except they are without matter. There's this important sense in which when the mind grasps essences abstractly, we are piggybacking on our awareness of the forms in the sensible objects. So I think just very concretely, when we talk about the mind and what it's doing, we're talking about understanding the world. We're talking about saying what something is. We're talking about being a scientist and saying, what is this life form? And grasping the essence of some particular phenomenon or other in the natural world. And so we give an account of it, and that account is abstract in its own way, and we might think of it as this grasping of an essence, you know, as understanding. But of course, it relies on our perception and the rest of it.
Let me just read a paragraph from the Gendlin here about interpreting that passage. So Aristotle fashions the new concept, tool of tools, from the proposition, the understood forms are to nous, as the made tools are to the hand. Aha, we say. So we must guard against reading this as if nous were itself one more form or kind, which nous makes. The hand does not make itself. The nous does not make itself. Aristotle thinks it comes into the soul from the outer cosmos. This is from Generation of Animals, another text. Just as the daylight comes from there. A form of forms is not a universal, rather it makes universals. Universals do not exist except as concepts in the soul. Of course, you have a universal concept of hand, but this does not make tools. And nous is not even defined by a universal concept, because as he said earlier, the essence of nous is not the concept, but its activity of concept making. The activity of enacting universals is not a universal. So even calling it a form, I mean, we're committed from the very beginning of this treatise that the soul as a whole is a form, right? Is the form of the human body. But there's something about nous at its highest level of abstraction that makes it so that he still is able to say that, no, actually the soul doesn't need a human body. It could be eternal. It can contemplate eternal things. It can exist apart from a body, because even though he wants to root it in a body by, just like you were saying, Wes, that thinking has images, it abstracts from images. That's how we get forms, is we abstract from real things that are perceived in the world. But yet the nous itself that is doing this is not itself a form. You can't just say it's the thing the body does or something. It is even higher than that. It is not a universal. Rather, it makes universal. It is pure activity.
One other way of thinking about this is going back to this whole idea that mind is nothing unless it's thinking, or I forget how he puts it. Mm-hmm. But it's almost as if the mind just is the objects of thought, because it's nothing before that. The mind can have no characteristic except its capacity to receive.
Where are you?
Just going back to 429A20, and has no actual existence until it thinks. The mind has no actual existence until it thinks. I mean, the way Mark and also, you know, the way you were talking about this reminded me of like a second order theory of consciousness, right? Where you get the functional activity of consciousness at one level, and then this reflective, I don't think this is right, but then this second tier on top of that, where consciousness comes about as the activity focused on the activity. That might not clarify things, but...
Well, you're pointing out one of the things that we skipped a little earlier in here is... Earlier, Dylan was saying that Aristotle didn't have a sense of consciousness. That's not one of the concepts that he deals with. But what he has instead is that all sensation involves sensing of itself,
right?
Sensing that it senses, which if you listen to our first Sartre episode, that means non-positional consciousness in Sartre's terms, but that will help no one except for me.
Remember when we used to have rules that we read before we started?
But he'll also say that about thinking though, right? That the thinking of the thought object is the mind thinking itself.
Right. So Gendlin described it like, why would you think that about sight? Well, how can you tell if you can see or not? There's no like separate sense that you like check. You just see something and you can't check whether you can see or not without actually seeing some particular thing, the ordinary operation of perception being active. Is it the same thing with thinking then? That
no, the thinking is different. Sorry, I was thinking is a whole different.
Okay,
it's even more extreme. But I mean, with the perception, it's just we are aware that we are aware.
Yeah,
our awareness that we are perceiving is part of perceiving.
So, it's important in Aristotle's discussion to be talking about the ways in which the intellect is similar to thinking is like perceiving and the ways in which it's different. So when you start talking about perception of perception, you know, the second order in that sense, I think you start to stray a little bit from the spirit of the text, where thinking about it hierarchically may not be a terrible way to go, which I thought was where Wes was going a minute ago, but then it didn't quite come to fruition, right? So I want to read a section from my translation, and you guys can feel free to read your versions of it. Although, Dylan, I have to say, I thought yours would be, after your description of it, I thought it would be clearer, but I found it a little more difficult. This is 429A going towards 429B, but not actually getting there. If then thinking is like perceiving, it will either be some kind of affection by the thought object. In other words, it will be like a sense where it's some kind of potential thing that gets acted upon and then actualizes through a form from an object, or some such thing. It must then be something unaffected, which yet receives its form and is potentially of the same kind as its object, but not the same particular, and the intellect must stand in that relation to objects of thought in which the perceptive faculty stands to those of perception. The part of the soul, then, that is called intellect, is before it thinks in actuality none of the things that exist. This makes it unreasonable that it be mixed with the body because it would have a quality, blah, blah, blah.
This is the part that I was harping on before about the mind being nothing, as having no actual existence until it thinks, and being nothing but pure potentiality.
Pure potential, yeah.
Yeah. Consideration of the sense organs and of sensation makes it clear that the unaffectiveness of the perceptive and of the noetic faculties are not alike. So this is where he's saying perception and thinking are not the same. For a sense loses the power to perceive after the excessiveness, you know, after something excessively perceptible, whereas the intellect has thought something extremely thinkable, it thinks lesser objects, not the less. If the intellect is somehow built on the back of perception, we still don't understand what that means, that you've got these senses working individually and in conjunction to be able to take common objects, in other words, almost get into this ratio as things which can be affected by objects. And the intellect is somehow a second order or supervening thing on that, whether it's self-reflective in the way that you were talking about being aware of its own, you know, the being aware of your own awareness, or whether it's simply something that emerges or sits on top of it. The point is that the object, if you can talk about it in that way, of the intellect would be not an object that exists in the world in the way that it does for the senses individually and combined, but would be an object that somehow comes out of or is somehow in those senses already. And since the senses only take on a form of the objects, then if you want to talk about there being an object of thought, it is already going to be a form because it's going to be made up of something out of these combined senses, which themselves are already only receiving forms. But because it crosses across all of those senses and all those second order objects, then its object would be a form or would be forms, but we can't think of a way in which the intellect, or at least the intellect, is not going to be structured in such a way that it's somehow the potential for all of these sensible forms.
Now, before we go any further with that, let's stop for a second and talk about our sponsor, The Great Courses. We are big fans of The Great Courses. We love learning about so many things at our own pace for the pure pleasure of it. And that's why we're excited about something new from The Great Courses. It's The Great Courses Plus Video Learning Service with unlimited access to thousands of fascinating subjects. The Great Courses Plus has nearly 5,000 video lectures in subjects like history, science, photography, cooking, of course, philosophy, and more, taught by award-winning professors and experts from National Geographic, the Smithsonian, and the Culinary Institute of America. With The Great Courses Plus, you can watch as many different lectures as you want at any time from anywhere on your TV, laptop, tablet, or phone. Partially Examined listeners can get a new introductory offer to The Great Courses Plus free for 1 month. The Great Courses lecture series are normally priced at $200 to $300 each, but now you can get unlimited access to the entire Great Courses Plus library completely free for 1 month. So go sign up now for your free 1 month trial. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. If you go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/store, you're going to see the 2016 Partially Examined Life calendar featuring the ultra cool artwork of Sterling Bartlett. If you enter the offer code CALENDAR5, that is calendar and the number 5 at checkout, you'll get $5 off your calendar order. Okay.
I think it's good to be here to make a distinction between the sensible forms and the forms that are the objects of thought, which are essences. So those are different. So when we grasp the essence of, it's one thing to have the perceptible form of the tree, to have that affect us. It's another thing to know what a tree is and to be able to say what it is, to give an account of it, a scientific account. That's when we grab the essence, and that's what we do with thought. And it's relying on our perceptions, of course, but it's not simply us taking our perceptions and then making them the objects of thought. There's, I guess we'd have to give a whole count of what it is to investigate things and to come to understand them, but I would say it's more complicated than, right? Do you see what I'm saying? So I think you were taking my second order theory and kind of going with it, and then I'm saying it's not, yeah.
No, so. I don't disagree with that, Wes. I think what I'm trying to say is if there's a second order relation here, it's more on the order of a hierarchy that's built out of object through sense, form goes from potentiality to actuality, like the form-matter distinction. And then you have a second level where you have all these forms that are being actualized in the senses, which in turn become the objects of thought or the basis somehow of the objects of thought, versus the notion of sight knowing that it's seeing and hearing knowing that it's hearing, this self-reflective, which I felt wasn't as prevalent in the text versus trying to build something hierarchically. That's what I was trying to get to.
Well, and the self-reflective thing brings up a problem, which is part of what that Gendlin quote that I read was trying to address, that he says a sense can sense itself. You sense that sight is going on. But can you think...
A sense can't sense itself.
It can. It does.
The sense is aware that it is... sense, yeah, but there's not sensing. Okay, just because he has a whole section about how it can.
Yep, no, that's, you're right. That's more precise.
You can't see yourself seeing, but you can be aware that you're seeing.
Well, the eye doesn't sense the eye, and if it did, we'd be in trouble.
So I was gonna contrast that with the, you know, if the sense can sense itself, in that the seeing contains the sensation that sight is going on. In that sense, it is sensing itself, and contrast that with the fact that the organ of thought is not something that can become an object of thought.
No, it is, though.
Because we've already said the organ of thought, but the organ of thought is pure potential. It is nothing. And then it is also, when it is acting, it is pure activity.
Well, he has a whole section on this, though. 429B.
Let's get into that.
So our second problem is whether the mind itself can be an object of thought.
There you go.
So he's worried here because for either mind will be present in all other objects, if that is mind is an object of thought in itself and not in virtue of something else, and what is thought is always identical in form, or else it will contain some common element which makes it an object of thought like other things. In the end, I think he's going to say mind can think itself. We have that reflective capacity. But if we do have that reflective capacity, then how do we explain that the mind also thinks objects of thought? Is it that they are also mind-like? Are they other minds that we're, you know, it's this type of worry, because he's thinking that there's going to be this sort of commonality between whatever it is that that mind is directing its attention to. Or there is the explanation which we have given before of the phrase being acted upon in virtue of some common element, that mind is potentially identical with the objects of thought, but is actually nothing until it thinks. What the mind thinks must be in it the same sense as letters are on a tablet which bears no actual writing. This is just what happens in the case of the mind. It is also itself thinkable, just like the other objects of thought. For in the case of things without matter, that which thinks and that which are thought is thought are the same. This is this really interesting assertion that when the mind thinks an object of thought, it is also thinking itself. That which thinks and that which are thought are the same. The mind is nothing. So this is what I was saying, you know, how the mind is nothing until it is actually thinking. And then the mind simply is the objects of thought. It's this really interesting idea.
Which it would have to be if the mind as pure potential is nothing.
Right.
Right. Then what is it? What else is it going to become?
It's nothing in actuality. Yeah.
Well, he says nothing until it thinks. And then it is the objects of thought.
Right. Which makes it interesting, like, then, well, how do we distinguish between me thinking of the number two and you thinking of the number two?
Well, you don't.
Not insofar as it's thinking.
So insofar as it's thinking, it is the universal noose. It's not me and you.
No, once you get to that point, there is no, he gets into that in chapter five, in the nous poeticon, or whatever it's called. And there's a lot of literature on this, but it's what he calls the active mind, which they take to be God. Then you seem to get this very Berkeleyan account of the knowability of things being grounded in this universal active mind, which it's very cryptic. But yeah, I think to the extent that the mind engaged in an object of thought, there is no distinction between me thinking some object of thought and you thinking it. It just is the essence of the thing. And at the point, you understand that there isn't just Marx's particular take on the essence of some biological form and then Wes's take on it. Once we've grasped that, once we've understood that, it is just the thought object itself. That is the thinking. And it's not Mark or Wes that does the thinking. There is just is the thinking.
And I threw out the example of a number, which I think on second thought is not right, because there are degrees of abstraction. So it comes down to what the difference between the thing and its thisness is, its essence. So we were talking about a dog, the individual thing, which even animals can perceive other dogs, and dogness, the essence of dog. And those are distinct in the case of a perceptual object like that. As you go up the ladder of abstraction and are talking about the number two, even there's a difference between the number two as an individual and the concept of two and two-ness, that really the number two is something that we see in individual object. It's empirical. And moreover, it has, as I was saying earlier in giving what Aristotle's conception of matter is, it actually has matter to it, that when you see number two, it's not just, it presupposes its matter, which is the whole series of numbers, and it presupposes this empirical realm in which counting occurs. So you have to go even higher up the level of abstraction to talk about, I guess, metaphysical objects. I don't, you know, the forms of logic, I'm not sure exactly what these things are. And in that case, the thing and its essence are one in the same. And also, the thing and the thing thinking the thing are one and the same.
You're saying the particular and the essence are the same?
Yes.
Hmm.
That seemed to me a corollary of this thing that we were just saying, is that the thought and the thinking of the thought are the same.
Well, look at what he says in following the passage I just read. In the things which have matter, each of the objects of thought is only potentially present. He's trying to address this idea now. Well, does that mean the world is made of ideas or mind objects, right? If what I've just said is true, the mind can think itself and the mind thinks of objects of thought. Does that mean that everything in the world, that when we grasp the essence of something, we're grasping a mind entity? You know, he's asking the Berkeleyan question. And he says, well, no, the object of thought is only potentially present in the thing. Hence, while material objects will not have mind in them, for it is apart from their matter that mind is potentially identical with them, mind will still have the capacity of being thought. That's a little confusing. But material objects will not have mind in them. I don't know how to make sense of this idea that a particular object is its essence. Its essence makes it a particular. I agree with that.
Well, I'm saying as you go up the level of abstraction, so you're not talking about particulars anymore.
Okay.
I mean, which the number two is one that we normally think of as a case of, it is just a concept, but actually that's kind of an intermediate case for Aristotle.
But dogness wouldn't be, right?
No, that is very close to the level of a straight abstraction.
Yeah. I think, you know, when Aristotle is thinking about the essence of a dog, he's thinking about everything we can understand about it as scientists. So in a full account. So dogness, I'm not sure does justice to it.
Maybe we shouldn't use dogness then.
No, I'm not. Yeah, I'm not trying to correct us out of that. I'm just saying it sounds very Platonic. And and I may be wrong about this, but that's my impression of when Aristotle is talking about essences is something more practical.
But the important thing here, just thinking about the way the distinction of thinking is, another dog would perceive, the retriever would perceive the Labrador, right? But it would not be in Aristotle's understanding. It might even, or would also have an imagination about it. It would have memory about that dog, stuff like that. But it would not be thinking about dogs.
Yeah, it could never ask the question, what is a dog? And it could never begin to answer that question by describing species or describing dog behavior or doing this or doing that. Yeah, so
that dog might wonder where its friend was. It might come back to the backyard and be imagining that the dog was there in the yard and wondering where it is, stuff like that. But it would always be about a particular dog.
Yeah, it has the sensible form down, but
yes,
but it can't do the thinking. Yeah.
Let's see. We still haven't made the connection to 432 to get to the form of forms. Can we just try to work through those intervening? I see 431.
A, chapter 7.
I don't know. Is there anything in A that we want to read? I was looking at B, but I'll back up.
I glossed chapter 7.
So 431A, knowledge when actively operative is identical with its object. And then the rest of it is just baffling.
But potential knowledge is prior in time in the individual, but not prior even in time in general. For all things that are come to be are derived from that which is so actually. Somebody have a better translation there?
What he's saying here is that even though in time, you know, I may not know anything about dogs and then I learn about them. So the potential knowledge has priority in time in that sense. It's first I have the potential to know and then I know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not prior in the sense, he's going to say even in time, because the thing already is what it is. And so the thing that we're going to think as an object of thought is prior. It makes the thing what it is and it before we ever come to it, before we ever come to understand it. So everything comes out of what actually is. So everything we know and understand is just based on those essences that are already there.
431A4, it is clear that the object of perception makes that which can perceive actively so instead of potentially so, for it is not affected or altered. Hence, this is a different form from movement. For movement is an activity of the incomplete, while activity proper is different, the activity of the complete. He's trying to say the mind is something that is complete. It is not like the senses being altered.
So he's famous for distinguishing two types of motion. One, kinesis, is this motion that moves towards. So if you're building a house, you're not done with it until you've built the house. There are other types of activity which are complete in and of themselves. So there are activities in the truest sense. Energeia is in the truest sense. So thinking is an example, but I was trying to.
What's another example?
Give you something more concrete. Yeah, well, so for instance, you've learned something, you know it, and now you're exercising that knowledge. That activity, it's not like there's a beginning and middle and end to it. You don't have to have finished something in order. It's complete in every moment. It's not like one of these processes where the activity isn't done until you've completed the house, until you've gotten to the end of it. So the end is inherent in the activity. And when we're trying to understand things, our desire to understand that end, which is part of our nature, is satisfied in the activity of understanding.
I find that difficult because it seems like you have some knowledge. You know, I learn how to be a doctor and then I exert that knowledge. Well, presumably I'm doing something in particular and that action does have a beginning and an end, and it has something that it can fail to do, just like building a house. It's not just I'm emitting my doctor knowledge. It is it involves a concrete activity.
I think we're talking about contemplative knowledge here.
So that does seem like the reason that you're having trouble coming up with another example of an activity that's complete in itself is because there are none. It's just really?
No, there are. I promise there are. I just don't remember.
Thinking about thinking?
From the secondary letter. This is explained very well in Christopher Shields' book, Aristotle. So go read it. But anyway, I didn't want to have a slog through that because this is a really difficult section.
Yeah.
I didn't spend enough time with it to understand it.
Is there anything later in chapter 7 that we want to pull out? Those things which are spoken of as in abstraction, one thinks of just as, if one thought actually of the snub, not qua snub, but separately qua hollow, one would think of it apart from the flesh in which the hollow exists. One thinks of mathematical entities which are not separate as separate when one thinks of them. This is a 431B12. That's very unhelpful in itself, but this is getting at that there are more and less abstract things you could think about. So the snub is his example that he standardly gives of something that's tied. There's nothing that's snub except a nose. Noses are snub. And so when you say snub, you're not contemplating the snub in the abstract. You're thinking about noses that are snub. But then if you move to hollow, well, it's not just noses that are hollow. It's there are many things that are hollow. And so that's more abstract. And then a mathematical concept is even more abstract than that, because it applies to more things. And it's not necessary to think of the matter so much when you think of these more abstract things. And somehow, again, that's supposed to build toward the very next verse. In general, the intellect in activity is its objects. So this is why I'm equating this increasing level of abstraction with the equation of the thinking activity with the object of thought.
Yeah, in my translation it says, is the things it thinks.
Yes, the Greek is ta pragmata noon, which I know you hate that, Mark, but it's a very elegant way of, it's the things being known, being thought.
I found the Greek stuff when I was going through the Gendlin, I think it was very helpful because, okay, this is in this section, whatever that term is for assertion and how he uses this over and over again and the different terms for knowledge, like that was useful, but just throwing them out in a way that people aren't going to remember them. I think in a podcast like this, you know, if we leave them knowing logos and nous, probably that's about as far as we can successfully get, but I'm happy to hear more. Chapter 8. I think is about the end of what we need to consider. Chapter 9 gets a little more into the tie between knowledge and action, but chapter 8 is summing up. Let us say again that the soul is, in a way, all existing things. For existing things are either objects of perception or objects of thought. And knowledge is, in a way, the objects of knowledge, and perception the objects of perception. How this is so, we must inquire. Knowledge and perception are divided to correspond to their objects, the potential to the potential, the actual to the actual. In the soul, that which can perceive and that which can know are potentially these things, the one, the object of knowledge, the other, the object of perception. This is not adding anything.
He's just sort of working through it. He's saying they must either be the things themselves or the forms. Surely they're not the things themselves. The stone is not in the soul, but rather the form.
Sure.
And then this is just where he gets to. Thus the soul is just like the hand, for the hand is the tool of tools and the intellect is a form of forms.
There you go. All right. We finally come full circle back to this point, or gotten up to this point that I threw in prematurely earlier to give us a sense of where we were going. Since there is no actual thing which has separate existence apart from, as it seems, magnitudes, which are objects of perception, the objects of thought are included among the forms which are objects of perception, both those that are spoken of as in abstraction and those which are dispositions and affections of objects of perception. And for this reason, unless one perceive things, one would not learn or understand anything. And when one contemplates, one must simultaneously contemplate an image. For images are like sense perceptions, except they are without matter. But imagination is different from assertion and denial, for truth and falsity involve a combination of thoughts. But what distinguishes the first thoughts from the images? Surely neither these nor any other thoughts will be images, but they will not exist without images.
Yeah. So thinking is not perception or imagination, but it relies on them.
Yes.
All right. In 9 and 10, we're getting more into bringing back this thing about motivation. So we had said that built right into perception is a notion of something's being pleasing or not, right? Does it have the right ratio? And when you think about perception in animals and imagination in animals, and last time we talked about desire, these are all hooked together so that I don't want to say he's giving a pragmatic theory, but the way he outlines this in chapters 9 and 10 is it's that a perception really only sort of comes to fruition when it results in the animal reacting to the perception to go toward it or away from it. Perception is not just about seeing that something is there. It's about survival. And likewise, reason, so this gets us right into the ethics, is really about contemplation of the good. That when you get a hold of something that is properly abstracted up the ladder from the perceptual objects, then, well, first he thinks it can't be wrong. Does anybody know why nous cannot be wrong?
Yeah, I mean, because wrongness involves predication. And nous is more like perception in the sense that it's not predicative.
So you're contemplating a concept. You're contemplating dogness.
An essence, yeah. So it's a direct intuition. Let's put it, an intellectual intuition. It's not a judgment that you're making. It's not a predicative judgment where you say X is Y.
So it really is like a sense. It's our mind sense.
Yeah.
Except it's contemplating a universal, right? It's contemplating a form.
Yeah. An essence.
Yeah, the material for it is not the kinds of things that are material for our senses. The material for it are forms.
And so one of the forms it can, and this is not really spelled out in here, but just as the going toward or away from the object, the aesthetic reaction, the survival reaction is, in a sense, the culmination of perception, at least when it comes to practical reason, then seeing the essence of the good and being able to, you know, overrule your gut instinct that is telling you to move forward or away, that we add in what is of benefit, not just at the moment, but over time. And then we sort of get higher and higher to in different levels of abstraction and contemplate the form of the good. And that ultimately tells us.
Where are you reading? Or, oh, here. Okay. So 433B, I think. The former is the practical good. Huh.
I don't know that the term form of the good shows up in here anywhere, but this is how I was reading it. Obviously, if the noose gets at forms, and adding reason is what enables us to resist temptation and pursue the good, then we're contemplating the form of the good, right?
I think he thinks that desire is something that sort of crosses across all the faculties.
Yep.
And so I think we can just have a basic desire for the good.
Sure.
But I'm speaking speculatively here because...
Well, no, and this is in reaction to Plato. Remember back in the Republic that we've got the three parts of the soul are the intellect and the spirit and the desire. And he wants to say, no. In fact, he's got a whole thing in here that says intellect by itself would not motivate you to do anything. There has to be some desire. And so, like you just said, Wes, that, you know, that there are desires at all three of these levels. And the desire that is motivated by intellect is going to be necessarily correct in a way that ones motivated just by perception and imagination are not going to be.
So, for instance, he says things like, for the object of appetite, the object of desire produces movement, and therefore thought produces movement, because the object of desire is its beginning. So there's some sense in which thought inherits desire. It seems like he's saying we can be motivated by thoughts because desire is inherently implicated in thinking. In the same way that it piggybacks on perception, mm-hmm. for thought to work, it has to piggyback on perceptions. Thought inherits desire as well from perception.
That's the only way thought moves us.
Right, right.
Is by desire, unlike other things. So in some ways, it most manifests itself that way.
Yeah.
Well, and can we connect this back to teleology and call it a day? That somehow we've seen, he goes back in chapter 12 and starts summing up, oh yeah, yeah, everything that lives and has a soul must have the nutritive soul from birth to death. And then, well, sense perception is not necessary in all living things, but and starts just really going through the types of animals again and who has what kind of soul. So each of these is driven by a final cause, and it's only at the point of contemplation where we can actually make the final cause into one that we are consciously holding in mind and aiming at, as opposed to something that merely drives the whole thing just by the nature of the form. Anyway, that's how I saw this as ending with a nice bow on it, that this is a reminding us this is a theory of why animals do the stuff they do, because of their growing, thriving, thinking soul. And thinking is not like Nietzsche might think that, oh, an excess of thinking just detaches us from our animal instincts. It's the culmination of the teleology that was going on at all these levels. And it just allows us to see more clearly the true shape of the world and react to it appropriately and live on after death.
Well, maybe in that bow that you're thinking of, isn't it just at the end of 13 where he says that...
Read
it. Well, it says... The animal has the other senses, as we said, not for the sake of being, but for the sake of well-being. It has vision, sure. For example, so that it can see, since it lives in air or water, or generally in the transparent. It has taste on account of the pleasant and painful, so that it may perceive this in its nutriment and desire it and move itself, while it has hearing, so that something may be signified to it, and tongue, so that it may signify something to another. Interesting that the tongue here is not about taste, but about speech.
It seemed like a big letdown after all these very dense sections in chapters 12 and 13 that he's just going back and talking more about sea sponges and stuff.
It did kind of trail off at the end. I'd forgotten how hard a book that book is.
Yeah.
It's a really hard book. But to me, it's a hard book in a way that makes me want to keep reading it. There are books that I've read and books that we've read here that I'm like, I just don't even want to keep reading that book. Like Lacan is that way. You know, okay, whatever. It's not hard in an interesting way. reading this again, I can imagine I want to actually read it again later. I can understand why not just Thomas Aquinas, but somebody would sit and write a line-by-line commentary about it because they wanted to understand the book better. I totally get it.
Yeah, this is not going to sound very profound, but it's profound. It's so dense, and it can be caricatured as something as categorizing and, you know, and all the other, you know, ways that you might caricature Aristotle as dry. And, you know, yeah, you could take any sentence, any paragraph, and really do a lot of thinking about it. Now, that said, in my laziness, I have to admit I enjoy reading about Aristotle more than I enjoy reading Aristotle. Just, you know, if I were in the mode of sitting down and taking a paragraph and thinking about it, it'd be another thing. But so, yeah, I went on a tear just, you know, reading so many different.
Did you read all the essays in the Nussbaum?
I did.
Compendium? Wow. Franz Brentano.
I read the entire 400-page book, and I read some of these other books. But of course, it's not careful enough to give me anything but this kind of general feel, you know.
Uh-huh.
I haven't gone through and like systematically thought about or summarized as I like to do or any of that stuff. But
no, it's hard to regurgitate these things. The Gendlin moves so slowly just because it's really hashing through each line and is so then repetitious in that a lot of it does stick, but I couldn't reproduce large portions of it here.
The Gendlin, unfortunately, I didn't get all the way through because I was so into the other stuff. But I forgot how useful he is, you know. So I regretted not being able to get through all of them. But yeah, really difficult book, and I think it's nice to look at some of the secondary literature just to, if you're skeptical about how much there is, you will quickly be disabused of that by just looking at any commentary, any of the secondary literature on it.
Well, I do think that this second half, though, was much more hopping than the first half. It was far more interesting, more cool stuff brought up, even just slogging through all those chapters on perception in the first place, which we summed up here in the first, like, 2 minutes of our discussion. Yes, there's a little more in them, but not enough to make it worth getting through it. Whereas I think, you know, these first bunch of chapters on the mind are just, there's so many different cool things that are brought up. It seems more worth it. But that could just be the different way I prepared this time than last time. So I don't know. Other thoughts? Seth, you still with us? Put a bow on it.
Put a bow on it. If this was the book that was a topic for a seminar that I was taking, I probably would be much more into it than I was. I get frustrated sometimes when we read the hard Greek guys in translation because then you're making a call on who you're reading and then you got to go to the secondary literature and you're trying to dive back in without actually understanding. And I can sense the feeling that Dylan expressed, but I don't share it. I would not go and intentionally spend hours of my time going back through this. But I would happily, if I was in a position to take a class with some people and somebody who could walk me through it and we were kind of dig into it a little bit. So when we launch another Aristotle-only podcast, which will focus on the metaphysics for the first 6 years of its existence, then I'll get back on it.
I think this was a good way of sliding into the metaphysics, that it left me wanting to know more about substance and other stuff like that.
Hey, fans, if you made it this far, how about somebody is sharing some resources on a really, really good and clear explanation of the potential actual thing and how it functions in sensation. I think that would be a really foundational thing that would be helpful.
It's just that your eye turns red when you see something red. What is there else to understand?
Of course. Is that it? Yeah, no, it's obvious.
Yes. It becomes shaped like a dog. Your eye is shaped like a dog. Well, thanks, everybody. We're going to do something a little easier next time. We're going to have Massimo Piliucci, until recently from the Rationally Speaking podcast, joining us to read several letters about Stoic virtue from Seneca from the first century AD, specifically on the terrors of death, on old age, on the shortness of life, on pleasure and joy, on good company, on the happy life, on facing hardship, and on self-control. So that's going to be a party.
I can't control myself.
We should just take out all the ones that sound happy. We're just going to read old age, death, the shortness of life, hardship, the end.
On terror.
Speaking of a party and death and hardship, we're supported by your donations. Please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com to make a contribution. Big donors since last time have included John Halloran, Paolo Goulard, Richard Haynes, George Paulos, Michael Clark, Bill Cromarty, Brock Nadeau, Barry Thornhill, Robert Ralston, Stephen Williams, Andrew Rogers, John Tyndall, Laura Lochner, James Kane, Ted Hodgson, Jesse Rodriguez, Imad Zahir, Per Samuelson, Erica Parkinson, Kevin Rogers, Jacob Lundgaard, Steidel Berkland, Jesse Martinez, Leonard Wedgemark, Bruce Lochner, Tim Coromel, David Stanton, Denise McAllister, Chris Jarzombek, Christine Urquhart, Russ Baker, Alexander Conrad, Richard Ostrom III, Trixie Rawlinson, Renee Snow, Darren Siphon, Brian Woodring, and Richard Moore II.
Wow. Thanks, all those folks.
Gosh, yes. And to those people who bought our 2016 calendar, there's still some left. Come on, get them. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. Any specific call to action?
We need more Twitter followers. Go follow us on Twitter.
That was yours from last time.
Was it?
Yes. Follow Ask Chicky on Instagram. That's the call to action.
All right.
You started Ask Chicky finally?
Just on Instagram.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Wonderful you, wonderful you, wonderful you. And I'm convinced that the worst part is done, 'cause I believe that the world is swell and there's good in everyone. And I know that it's one of those times when I have to step back and stop consciousness here, 'cause I just can't believe you won't stay. Okay, except you. Wonderful you.